Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And folks, welcome back. We are ready to dive into the Massachusetts debates. So just to remind you, we also have the guidance on the Monarch stuff is on the Take Action page. We have our YouTube page, Reclaiming the Republic, and all you have to do is subscribe to that. And let me just go ahead and give you the good news. We have Paul, so we won't have to suffer with my reading. And so, Paul, welcome back. And are you ready to kind of dive in, or do you have any saved rounds on stuff that we've covered so far that you may have made notes for, or what?
Well, thanks. I'm glad you like my reading. I think I enjoy reading the way these people speak. It's not something that you hear very often in today's conversation.
Right. It's not easy. The way they structure their grammar is even different than the way we speak today. So
right. So I actually enjoy reading it and dissecting it. I did want to mention to you that I really enjoyed your show yesterday because you captured a lot of things I had been thinking about over the weekend. But we can go on.
Oh, so. Yeah. So follow the money. Who's gaining? And this is why there's so many people that are turning. We would probably call some of these people, you know, Republicans or what have you, but they're turning their back on the problem because they're benefiting from it. And so when so many people are benefiting from the problem, it's just like the conservative entertainers. It is antithetical to kill the golden goose that's laying your eggs.
Right.
So anyway, where we left off with Reverend Thatcher on Monday, the 4th of February, and he was kind of going through these arguments of why they needed to ratify the Constitution. And so we kind of left off midstream in his long discourse. But if you if you're ready to go ahead and start, it kind of starts off with let these arguments. So go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do that. Let these arguments be weighed, I dare say, sir. There is no man but what would conceive that a coercive power over the whole, searching through all parts of the system, is necessary to the preservation and happiness of the whole people. But I readily grant all these reasons are not sufficient to surrender up these essential liberties of the people. But do we surrender them? This Constitution had been compared, both by its defenders and opponents, to the British government. In my view of it, there is a great difference. In Britain, the government is said to consist of three forms: monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. But in fact, is but a few removes from absolute despotism. In the crown is vested the power of adding at pleasure to the second branch, of nominating to all the places of honor and emolument, of purchasing by its immense revenues the suffrages of the House of Commons. The voice of the people is but the echo of the king, and their boasted privileges lie entirely at his mercy. In this proposed form, each branch of power is derived either immediately or directly from the people. The lower house are elected. Hey, I'm going to stop here because I've got a question about what he's saying. Okay?
Okay, but before you ask your question, I'll let you formulate that. I find it ironic that what we're reading here is, you know, so George Mason, when we get to the Virginia ratification debates, he talks about, you know, because he's basically complaining that we shouldn't ratify the Constitution. And then he goes through this whole diatribe of how the militia will be dismantled. And what he's talking about, how the militia gets dismantled, is a violation of the Constitution. In other words, He's not saying that the Constitution's bad. He's just saying that the way this is, that they're, you know, this is what they're going to, if they violate it, this is how they can dismantle it, by violating it. Now, what we're reading here is somebody that's actually showing us how Britain, because they talk about coercion, you know, in the very, the first paragraph that you read, it says that there is no man but what would conceive that a coercive power over the whole, searching through all parts of the systems, is necessary to the preservation of the whole. So he's actually, if you look at the opposite side of that, the coercion has, would be necessary to collapse our government or to take control of it. And so when we talk, when we look at what happened in the Civil War and how Britain basically sent an army of diplomats and or spies into America to basically start buying out and corrupting those members of Congress to get them into office, giving them money to get into office, to basically get them to lay out their plan, which was the Organic Act and everything else that they did with corporations. And so, because Britain, I'll tell you, Britain was not happy that this little ragtag country was successful in beating them, and they weren't going to go away. They had every interest in trying to undermine us, which is why they so heavily invested in the South. And they were just, they were just tickled pink when, you know, for 2 years, the North couldn't even win a victory. They were going, we've got this thing done.
Right.
There's no doubt that they were counting their chickens. And then when the 14th Amendment came along and it sealed the door that the British Crown was not going to get a penny from us, because no state in the Union would be responsible for paying that debt.
Right.
Which basically forced the southern states to kind of join in, because if not, Britain would have been able to go in and then just co-opt them and take control, and then now we would have the British states, an allied British states to the south of us, working against us. And so this is where they came in and they created this facade and everything else. If you see my point, he's talking about how evil Britain really is and how they were corrupting their own people right here in this, in what you were reading. So go ahead. What's your question now?
So notice you said yesterday you were talking about how follow the money. And even as far back as the Civil War, people don't stop and think, follow the money. It has been stuck in Great Britain's craw ever since the Treaty of Paris, that we got away.
Right.
Okay. And so, yep. And I don't know, frankly, GR, I don't know if they've gotten over it.
No. Okay. So, but hold on here.
Okay.
They're sitting there laughing. So they're orchestrating this whole globalist thing. You got to realize that they're behind this whole globalist movement. And, but nobody really knows this, because what they had to do is they had the working monarchs of the British Crown, because if you really look at the world, last time I checked, there were, I think, 13 monarchs, the British monarchy, and then these other sub-state monarchs throughout Europe. But Britain basically is the one that rules them all, because they actually corrupted the whole world. And it was, there's no doubt in my mind, the Illuminati had to have, I don't have any evidence of this, but if you look at how the Illuminati was doing what they were doing in trying to destroy the nations and religions of Europe, which with Jot Robinson, that book, you know, that the proofs of, the proofs of conspiracy, right. So if you look at how it all laid out, Britain really had to basically play in the background, or everybody would have known that they were the key enemy. And they were very successful in writing this out. The whole world has been watching this coronation of this despot that's coming to power.
Yeah.
And I don't think that his son is going to be any worse. I think his son will be even far worse.
Wow.
And so, because, I mean, these guys... I don't know if Charles is really that, you know, far entrenched in the, you know, the perversion and so forth, but I believe one of the princes went to the island of Epstein. And so I just look at how, you know, they've been kind of involved in all of this and how they're just, you know, the big surprise is, oh, well, yeah, we're all going to fall under this world kind of a monarchy or this global government, you know, where they're just going to kind of take care of everything. And that's when they can basically poke us Yanks in the eye and say, oh, you really thought you got away, didn't you?
So when we look at this question, I'm reading this thing.
Uh-huh.
I said, oh, I've got a question.
Yeah.
And here's what stops me is I'm going through here. Who is it speaking? Reverend Thatcher.
Uh-huh.
Begins to describe how the monarchy has such an influence over the British system.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And then he says, the voice of the people is but the echo of the king, and their boasted privileges lie entirely at his mercy. So he goes on there, and then he says, you see, the lower house are selected directly from persons who are qualified to vote for the representatives of the state. Next, the expiration of 2 years, become private men unless they're kept. Okay. So what I wanted to say, the voice of the people, is that I lost my place. Government has said it consists of three forms. He's describing to the Americans what the British system is. But then I think you pointed it out about how at the earlier when he said how the coercion is necessary. I missed that. Am I misunderstanding what he was saying? Oh, here, coercive power over the whole.
Yes.
Searching all parts of the system.
Right.
Is necessary to preservation and happiness of the whole people. Is there a conflict there?
No. So I think what he's talking about is that we actually have to be guarding ourselves regarding the coercive power that, you know, it doesn't take root and take control of the whole. And so this goes back to the Bill of Rights for the 21st century, where I basically, you know, identify that if you really want to have, you know, election integrity, you have to make all elections local, because right now it really doesn't matter. You know, these people are fighting over going back to paper ballots and all of that. But that doesn't stop the money influence. It doesn't stop the corruption of the individuals. I mean, yeah, you may actually have, you know, be able to root out the ability to manipulate the voting, but you're not manipulating the voters to vote the way you got to stop that too. And you got to actually stop the ability of corrupting the actual individuals, because when you look at making all elections local, you not only stop the money from coming in, but you identify who these representatives are. These are representatives of the Constitution, first and foremost, and then next, only those people within the election area. So this is why, you know, it's not a leap. It is not a leap. When we make all the elections local, as far as the influence, no money can come from outside the election area, then when that representative in your state legislature or even in Congress, you know, has anybody come in their door, no one should be able to be allowed to talk to these folks. And it has to be clearly documented that a non-constituent is bending your representative's ear.
Sure.
And as a matter of fact, I think I mentioned this in my first book. If not, it was in my head that I wanted to add it, but I thought I for sure that these guys needed to be mic'd and camered, you know, like police have these cameras on.
Body cams.
A body cam, so that regardless of where they go, until they walk into their home, you know, and their home is kind of like fenced, you know, with all this digital fencing to ensure that nobody can go in while they're in their personal sanctuary and be able to coerce them with money or anything else. In other words, you know, there's got to be a cost to becoming a public servant. You should not have this ability of a private life so that you can run around and sneak and be able to take money or be co-opted by either vice or what have you, so that, you know, your purity and your integrity stays intact in supporting the Constitution first and so forth. But I guess the reality is, because with everything that they do, as long as they're not violating the Constitution, but I'm just telling you, the devil knows where the weaknesses, cracks, or what have you, that they can do other things. And it, you know, it's just a matter of time where, you know, water or whatever the form of erosion is, you know, to keep on, next thing you know, you've got a Grand Canyon running through your government.
Well, sure. And you know, we've done, GR, you can only imagine how deep this money hole is.
Well, here's a question, because this is the other thing I was going to say. If you look at all of the money that Portugal and Spain actually obtained, and because they came to the South America and Central America and Latin America, right? They came and they took everything. If it was gold, if it was any riches, they stole it. England did not do that. England built and basically controlled and created a commonwealth of the whole world, kind of similar to the Roman Empire. And where is the money of Portugal and Spain? In other words, they were so short-sighted that they spent it on the opulence and luxuries instead of holding it and investing it to be, you know, to actually be a world power, because they had the money to be a world power.
Got it. It had to be a different cultural mindset, which is probably why we hear this phrase, the sun never sets on the British Empire. It was a different cultural mindset.
Yes.
So wherever they went, they entrenched themselves. And it was everywhere. It was India. It was Africa. It was China. It was, you know, the Western Hemisphere. Everywhere Britain went, it was just, you know, the Spanish and Portuguese, and maybe even I don't know if the French as much, had the same mindset as Britain. It just, you know, and imagine a country the size of Georgia, right?
Right.
Right. And has this influence over the entire world.
Well, their focus from the beginning, I guess, after being ran over by France a couple of times, and, okay, you know, and actually being ran over by Spain until they finally beat the British Armada, I think that their mind model was, we have, you know, our focus needs to be on control, you know, okay, and expand our control and control and control. In other words, I mentioned the other day where Joe Kennedy became so rich that he no longer
spend all his money.
Yeah, he was no longer able to spend all that money. So the you know, he realized that, well, the one thing he could do is he could start buying control. And when he started buying control and obtaining control, it became, you know, this unquenchable thirst. And I think that was the whole point of the British Crown, that they realized that, you know, there's a greater satisfaction, because once you obtain control, then, you know, it's you don't lose your stuff. Now, with Spain, they weren't even thinking that way. With Portugal, they weren't thinking that way. Mm-hmm. And so, because look, I mean, we see today how artifacts and riches are coming out, you know, that this country that was there, like Germany or what have you, had stole artifacts from other nations as they conquered them. You know, Britain never did that. At least not as this obvious, you know, we're going to rob you as we conquer you. They just didn't do that. What they did was it was all about control. And, you know, one of the last countries that they were controlling, you know, before the American, you know, stand up and the revolution was China. And they were controlling them with the opium. I mean, they basically got all the Chinese, enough of them, so addicted to opium as they were bringing it out of India, that they were exchanging opium for tea, because they didn't want the evil. And so China has learned their lesson. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if China's really learned their lesson. I believe that Britain is because they've been instrumental in moving the communist movement throughout the world.
Britain.
So who brought communism here to America and who entrenched it into our education system? It was Britain. It was the Fabian Society from Britain.
Wow.
And that was in the 1800s. And so there's no doubt in my mind that Britain was calling the shots in making sure that was it Stalin? No, it was Lenin, because I believe Lenin was in the Commonwealth of Canada, and they were the ones that said, hey, you know, let him go, because they felt that he was the one that would help them end the Bolshevik Revolution and the takeover. And there was no doubt in my mind that Britain was the one that basically told America, because we had actually had a resolution to support China against the Mao takeover, I should say the communist takeover. And there's no doubt in my mind, Britain has been involved in all of this.
Wow. Well, that's a pretty strong position to take.
Well, I mean, you look at what the Bible says. The Bible says that, you know, there'll be, you know, all these seven continents or these different crowns, and one crown would rule them all, kind of like the Lord of the Rings and how...
Yeah, one ring to rule them all.
Right. And basically, Britain had, they had their eye, because I believe that they were co-opted. It's just like the Rothschilds and everybody else. They all started working together on this big game. You know, but there was plenty of seats, because it's a big world to share your power and influence. But this is where the secret societies, you know, basically corrupted people.
Well, you know, one thing that you mentioned, and you see it, is that once you start buying influence or buying power, it seems like an unquenchable thirst, you know. I mean, names come to mind, like George Soros, Klaus Schwab. It seems like once they start this direction, they just can't stop.
That's right. That's why I was pointing out, you know, the lack of foresight, the lack of focus by Portugal and France, not Portugal and France, Portugal and Spain, how, you know, they were holding all of this wealth. But that wealth means nothing in contrast to control and power.
Right. Amazing.
Right.
Okay. Well, we've gone down a little bit.
Yeah, we got basically a minute and a half. So why don't you finish this paragraph, and then we can, you know, wait for the break. So go ahead. In this proposed form.
Where is this? In this post form, where am I?
You're towards the bottom. It starts on the right side. In this proposed form, each branch of power.
There we go. This proposed form, each branch of power is derived either immediately or directly from the people. The lower house are elected directly by those persons who are qualified to vote for the representatives of the state, and at the expiration of 2 years, become private men unless their past conduct entitles them to a future election. The Senate are elected by the legislatures of the different states and represent their sovereignty.
There you go. So right there, folks, we have hardcore evidence that the state legislature is, the Senate, is responsible to represent the state sovereignty. Now, when we look at the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment changed, you know, how the senators were to be chosen, but it didn't change right here where it says to represent their side. So it didn't change their responsibility of who they were supposed to represent.
Correct.
The amendment couldn't change that, because the whole focus was, but everybody knows, and it comes right down to this, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so we got about 15 seconds, 10 seconds to break, but... You know, all these adages just start ringing out. And so anyway, hold on, Paul. And folks, we will be right back after we go into this break. But I hope everybody is starting to recognize how, when we look at what Britain and how they were acting then, they only magnified that as they obtained more and more control. Because look at the British Commonwealth today. I mean, there's lots of states that are involved in the British Commonwealth. Folks, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we get ready to dive in, we've got, you know, there is a good chance we might be able to finish today, but I think the dialogue of the discussion as we move forward is really important, because when you start hearing things, you start thinking about, well, what about this? And what are they saying here? Really? Anyway, the ratification debates are so revealing, because these men openly and honestly talk about what the heck's happening. And even though I may make the anti-federalists out to be these scoundrels, you know, in protecting the cabal, I think that there were many people that were a part of the anti-federalists that were, you know, they were sold on this. It's not like they were, you know, involved in understanding the issues like James Monroe. James Monroe really hadn't come to a point of political involvement. So when he was an anti-federalist, I think he was more wooed by Henry and other people. And instead of Henry saying, hey, we need to stop this so that we can maintain our power here, you know, Henry's argument was, we need to stop this because this is a really bad deal. And, you know, he convinced Monroe, but Monroe ended up turning his vote. So, in other words, people were very, I don't want to say coerced, but they were influenced by some of the old-time leaders. Henry was a big one. Clinton in New York was another. That, you know, people, yeah, they were just, I'd say sycophants maybe. But anyway, because you'll always find that. But anyway, it's all fascinating. I love reading the ratification debates. But anyway. Anything else, or okay?
Let's ready to go on to the next one.
All right, here we go.
Just finished talking about the difference between the House and the Senate. So now he goes on. These powers are a check on each other and can never be made neither dependent on one another or independent of the people. The president is chosen by the electors, who are appointed by the people.
Stop right there. Stop right there. So who chooses the president?
The electors.
And who chooses the electors?
The people choose the electors.
There you go.
So there is this level of insulation, which we don't appreciate, that is between the general government and the people.
But the fact of the matter is, we don't have that insulation. The parties control it all now.
Correct.
And
okay, that insulation is supposed to be there. There are layers of protection at each level of government
Yeah, so here's my question. Mm-hmm. Who is it that's really controlling the parties?
Well, it's not necessarily the people, because the parties are just...
See, this is why it's so hard for people to really, because most people have to follow the money, you know, so you can see these direct connections. But in this case, this goes down to the rule of control.
Right.
So who is it that benefits by controlling the outcome of our presidency?
oh, whoever can afford to pay for it.
Well, it's actually Britain. So it's actually Britain, okay. Because we've basically fought Britain's wars. We've done all of these things that, you know, have benefited Britain. Because when you look at it, who benefits? Sometimes it's not a direct money. I mean, there's a lot of contractors that love the fact that they have illegal aliens, you know, and so they're benefiting on the business side. It may have something to do with money, but you got to look at who's benefiting and how. And in this aspect, who would benefit from controlling and taking over and seizing unconstitutionally how we choose our president? Why the president? And I'll just say this, because most people truly believe that the president has all these powers. This is why we see our president ever since these days, ever since the mid-1800s, we've had nothing but a string of kings. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt was a king. Taft, well, not so much Taft, but Wilson, he was a king. Then we had FDR, Truman.
Wow.
So when you start looking at who the guys that really yielded power and pushed us down the progressive path, they were acting kings in America.
Someday, when we get an opportunity, I would like to know how the American people allowed FDR to just steal their gold and get away with it. But that's, I would be going down another rat hole. It just came to mind when you mentioned it.
Yeah.
FDR.
Sure. Sure. So go ahead.
Okay. So
I won't interrupt you anymore. Go ahead.
Something might get interesting. You know, the president was chosen.
Okay.
By
okay. If I can't control the temptation. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. The high courts of justice arise from the president and Senate, but yet the ministers of them can be removed only upon bad behavior. The independence of judges is one of the most favorable circumstances to public liberty, for when they become the slaves of a venal, corrupt court and the hirelings of tyranny, all property is precarious and personal security at an end. A man may be stripped of all his possessions and murdered without the forms of law. Thus, it appears that all parts of the system arise ultimately from the people and are still independent of each other. There are other restraints which, though not directly named in this Constitution, yet are evidently discerned by every man of common observation. These are the government of the several states and the spirit of liberty in the people. I can't resist saying how important this is.
Right.
You know, the government of the several states, you know, the states are the parent. The federal government is the child, and that's been flipped.
Right.
Okay. So.
Right.
Are we wronged or injured? Our immediate representatives are those to whom we ought to apply. Their power and influence will still be great, but should any servants of the people, however eminent their stations, attempt to enslave them from this spirit of liberty, such opposition would arise as would bring them to the scaffold. But admitting that there are dangers in accepting this general government, yet are there not greater hazards of rejecting it? Such is, Mr. President, the state of our affairs, that it is not in our power to carve for ourselves. To avoid the greatest and choose the least of these two evils is all that we can do. What, then, will be the probable effects if this Constitution be rejected? Have we not reason to fear new commotions in this commonwealth? If they arise, can we be always certain that we shall be furnished with a citizen who, though possessed of extensive influence and the greatest abilities, will make no other use of them than to quiet the tumult of the people, to prevent civil war, and to restore the usual course of law and justice? This question he's asking... asking if these problems come up, can we guarantee that someone's going to say, hey, we got to get this right. Okay.
Right.
That's interesting. In other words, someone needs to see this and stand up. That's what they recognize, that they are creating a government, a system for the ages. and they're asking these questions about, you know, how will this?
So he starts it off right here up above, and he says, what then will be the probable effects if this Constitution be rejected? Have we not reason to fear new commotions in this Commonwealth? If they arise, can we always be certain that they will be furnished with a citizen who, then possessed of extensive influence and the greatest abilities, will make no other use of them than to quiet the tumult of the people, to prevent civil war, and to restore the usual course of law and justice? So, in other words, do they really want to bank? Because really, everybody saw that the Confederacy was the states were being pitched against each other, and if they maintained the course with the Confederacy, that the Union would eventually dissolve. And these men knew that the Union. So this goes back to the exact same conversations that really came up during the Constitutional Convention, when some issues that were, even though they may be repugnant, the sentiments of the minds in that convention felt that the unity was far more important. Had they not, and had they basically said, because, you know, it takes time for people to finally, you know, it takes time for an alcoholic to admit that they're an alcoholic. You know, you go through this course. I mean, when you look at the point when somebody really became the alcoholic, it's not the next day they say, oh, you know, I acknowledge I've been an alcoholic. No, I mean, that turning is such a slight thing that next thing you know, you've lived a long period of time as an alcoholic. And then it takes a lot to get to that point of recognizing and then making the necessary changes. And what we're looking at is with the Republican, the Confederacy, that getting states to give up slavery, giving states to make, you know, the necessary changes. And the biggest one that stood out were the Southern states, but they weren't ready to give that up. They really believed that what they were doing, and in one sense, the allowing of that, this is why I thought, and I still believe, that they should have maintained the Union. They just should have said, go ahead and leave. And then if those three states would have left the Union or left that convention, then I think that they probably would have said, all we need is this many states. And so instead of 9 of the 13, they would have said, okay, well, considering those three states out, then we would want, you know, 7 of the 10.
So you just answered the question I was about to ask, is why didn't we just let them walk? You know, let those three states just go.
These men recognized that the unity was important, and they probably recognized that the Southern states could easily be coerced, co-opted, and basically, you know, lured or, you know, lulled into Spain, France, Britain, or what have you. And
that would have been a perpetual thorn in the side.
It would have been. And so they go, you know, what are we risking here? Because, you know, even though all of the states had not given up, the northern states, because we already see this in the ratification debates where they're talking about, the northern states are actually getting rid of slavery. So they're starting to wake up. But, you know what happens when somebody, the day somebody stops smoking cigarettes, or right after they, you know, stop smoking cigarettes, you know, they become really, what's a good word for it? They become
hypersensitive.
Yeah, hypersensitive. Somebody starts, yeah, get that thing out of here. That's just, you know, and former smokers, they just become really intolerant towards that. And, you know, I look at the slavery in the North, that these people, you know, started recognizing the evil of what was going on. And they go, you know what, you know, we got to get rid of this. And they became hypersensitive. And the South, because they weren't there, and they didn't, as a matter of fact, the way they talked about it is the necessity, because they couldn't do the work themselves.
Sure.
And or at least they believe that they couldn't do the work themselves. But you know as well as I do, anybody, it just takes time to acclimatize yourself. You can. It doesn't regardless of who you are or your race or ethnicity, you can acclimatize and adjust and overcome those types of circumstances. They chose not to. It was so much easier to have somebody else, and that's what slavery did. That was the great evil of slavery, is earning your bread at the sweat of another brow.
Right. Wasn't Delaware a slave state?
Yes, Delaware. As a matter of fact, when you drive up, you know, along that coastal highway, go up over the causeway that takes you right into the south side of Maryland across the Chesapeake, and you drive up Maryland and up into Delaware, you'll actually see some of the old cotton fields out there.
Wow. See, this was a surprise to me. I thought Delaware was a northern state.
Well, they were a northern state in the Civil War, but they did grow cotton. I mean, cotton wasn't just a, you know, you've been in Virginia probably, and you've probably been in Pennsylvania. The West Coast is a hot, arid, humid place. You know, it's not like the East Coast. I mean, you can get all the way up into New York and have the oppressive humidity because that moist air is always coming up from the south because of the current of the Atlantic Atlantic Ocean brings that warm water and warm air all the way up. That's why hurricanes will hit New York or even go further. But when you look at the Pacific side of the continent, that's cold air, which, you know, we have really cold storms, rain and snowstorms and so forth.
Sure.
But, you know, our climate isn't conducive to necessarily, you know, citrus and those types of things where you could probably get away with growing citrus, you know, or warmer stuff, you know, palm trees, those types of things further north. But bottom line is, and I went down a rat hole, but bottom line, the concept of keeping the union was really the key, because they keep on talking about it. Even in Massachusetts, they said, we need to keep this union. And that's what he's saying here, is that we cannot afford to allow the union to dissolve because this would be the consequence. He said that, you know, we would be exposed to all of these other types of influences. And then if somebody actually came up with their greatest of abilities, we'll make no other use of them than to quiet. We expect them to actually make no other use of these abilities than to quiet the tumult of the people and prevent civil war and to restore the usual course? Probably not.
Right. Right. That clarifies my question.
Are we not? Okay. He goes on here and says, are we not in danger from other states when their interests or prejudice are opposite to ours? Keep on going.
Sure. And in such scenes of hostile contention, will not some Scylla drench the land in blood? I don't know what a Scylla is. Or some Cromwell or Caesar lay our liberties prostrate at his feet. Will not foreign nations attack us in our weak, divided condition and once more render us provinces to some potentate of Europe? Or will those powers to whom we are indebted lie quiet? They certainly will not. They are now waiting for our decision, but when they once see that our union is broken and that we are determined to neglect them, they will issue out letters of mark and reprisal and entirely destroy our commerce. He explains it right there.
Yeah, so most people, so those people who do not know what a mark of reprisal is, then that is the authorization by the government to seize anything and everything out there. In other words, it's basically, you know, Mad Max, Road Warrior, if it's out there and you can take it, it's yours. In other words, it lifts the laws of civility and say you can go ahead and plunder all you want.
Sure. In fact, I believe it's where the government gives privateers authorization to just go plunder.
Yes. And the reason why they don't want that to happen is because Blackbeard and those types of people, you know, rise up because they plunder for themselves. But technically, you're supposed to plunder and, you know, share that with the state.
Okay.
Anyway, right. but it opens the door for piracy and all sorts of bad behavior. Anyway, go ahead.
If this system is broken up, will 13 or even 9 states ever agree to another? And will Providence smile upon a people who despise the privileges put into their hands and who neglect the plainest principles of justice and honesty? After all, I by no means pretend that there is complete perfection in this proposed Constitution. Like all other human productions, it hath its faults. Provision is made for an amendment whenever from practice it is found oppressive. I would add the proposals which His Excellency hath condescended to lay before this honorable convention respecting future alterations are real improvements for the better, and we have no reason to doubt that they will be equally attended to by other states as they lead to common security and preservation. Some of the gentlemen in the opposition have quoted ancient history and applied it to the question now under debate. They have shown us the danger which arises from vesting magistrates with too much power. I wish they had gone on to tell the whole truth. They might have shown how nearly licentiousness and tyranny are allied, that they who will not be governed by reason must submit to force, that demagogues in all free governments have at first held out an idea of extreme liberty and have seized on the rights of people under the mask of patriotism. They might have shown us a republic in which wisdom, virtue, and order were qualities for which a man was liable to banishment, and on the other hand, boasting sedition and falsehood, the sure road to honor and promotion?
Yes, promotion. Yeah.
Am I missing what he's saying? That, let's see, liable, that on the other hand, boasting sedition and falsehood, the sure road to honor and promotion? Am I not reading that right?
Yes, no, you're reading it right. Yep.
Well, then maybe I don't understand what he's saying, because it sounds like
honor and self-promotion.
It doesn't say self-promotion.
That's what he's basically talking about. On the other hand, boasting, sedition, and falsehoods, the sure road to honor and promotion.
Okay. See, mm-hmm. I'm thinking in terms of honor in its classic meaning.
Sure.
Okay. I am sorry that it hath been hinted by some gentlemen in this house, as if there were a combination of the rich, the learned, and those of liberal professions, to establish and support an arbitrary form of government. Far be it from me to retort so uncharitable and unchristian a suggestion. I doubt not but the gentlemen who are of different sentiments from myself are actuated by the purest motives. Some of them I have the pleasure to be particularly acquainted with and can safely pronounce them to be men of virtue and honor. They have no doubt a laudable concern for the liberties of their country, but I would beg them to remember that extreme jealousy and suspicion may be as fatal to freedom as security and negligence. With respect to myself, I am conscious of no motive which guides me in this great and solemn question, but what I could justify to my own heart, both on the bed of death and before the tribunal of omnipotence. I'm a poor man. I have the feelings of a poor man. If there are honors and emoluments in this proposed constitution, I shall, by my profession and circumstances in life, be forever excluded from them. It is my wish and prayer that in the solemn verdict we are very soon to pronounce, we may be directed to that measure which will be fought for the glory, freedom, and felicity of my country.
There you go. So jumping down, there's a Major Lusk, and then Reverend Backus makes a comment regarding religious tests. And it's kind of a long comment, so let's go ahead and try to take a bite out of this, because we got about 4 minutes.
Oh, great. Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. President, I have said very little in this whole convention, but I now beg leave to offer a few thoughts upon some points in the Constitution proposed to us, and I shall begin with the exclusion of any religious test. Many appear to be much concerned about it, but nothing is more evident, both in reason and the Holy Scriptures, than that religion is ever a matter between God and individuals, and therefore no man or men can impose any religious test without invading the essential prerogatives of our Lord Jesus Christ. Ministers first assumed this power under the Christian name, and then Constantine approved of the practice when he adopted the profession of Christianity as an engine of state policy. And let the history of all nations be searched from that day to this, and it will appear that the imposing of religious tests hath been the greatest engine of tyranny in the world. And I rejoice to see so many gentlemen who are now giving in their rights of conscience in this great and important matter. Some serious minds discover a concern lest, if all religious tests should be excluded, the Congress would hereafter establish popery or some other tyrannical way of worship. Oh, popery or some other tyrannical way of purpose worship. But it is most certain that no such way of worship can be established without any religious test.
Right.
So is he referring to popery as Catholicism?
Yes, right. That's why it's capital P.
Okay. And so they seem to have an opposition to this.
Yeah, because the Catholic Church had not gotten a foothold here.
Okay.
And you got to understand that Britain broke away from the Catholic Church, but did they?
What do you mean?
Did Britain, when they established the Anglican Church, did they really get away from Britain, the British Empire, when they created the Episcopal Church, as they broke away from the Catholic Church so that the king could have his divorce? Did they really break away, or did the Pope and if you kind of look at how the empire goes, it's almost like, you know, when the hand is kind of severed off of power, it somehow gets into the uprising power and basically corrupts. So the Roman Empire was basically the world empire, and then the Spaniards kind of had this control. And who were the Spaniards? The Spaniards were a part of the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And so when Britain kind of broke away and they, you know, severed themselves and started becoming this empire, when the falling of the Roman Catholic Empire, because you got to understand that the Roman Empire was replaced by the Roman Catholic Empire, where the Dark Ages were, you know, where the Roman Catholic Church kind of, you know, spread across the whole land, and this was their tyranny of religion, and it caused all the wars of religion throughout Europe as everybody started kind of breaking away, and they were disunioned. Now, when England did it, I'm looking at, you know, how all these circumstances are going, that England was the last one, but I think it was penetrated by the corruption of the Roman Catholic Church. Because do you understand the Trinity, or the three flags with the three stars, that's in D.C., it's also in London, and that flag rises and flies somewhere else?
I was unaware of that. I know what the D.C. flag looks like.
So we're going into break. So actually not break, we're ending the show. And when we come back, folks, we will get into exactly where those three flags are. We will share this with you because this all goes back to the Organic Act and how we basically kneeled to these world dominators and allowed them to infiltrate us. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.